on the Pilot TV podcast this week, we have not one, not two, not three, but four TV shows for your viewing pleasure. And not to pull a spoiler in the opening seconds of the podcast, but it's a pretty good week for telly. Specifically, we catch up with Sarah Phelps' most recent labyrinth and mystery in Dublin Murders, look into the soul of contemporary romance in Amazon's Modern Love, witness East meeting West by way of Japanese gangsters and Kelly MacDonald in Giri Haji, and join Paul Rudd, Ashlyn B, and Paul Rudd in Netflix's Living With Yourself. And to top it all off, We Miss B makes her Pilot TV podcast debut, joining me to talk about her show, our show, and why I'm entirely wrong about comedy. I'm James Dyer, and welcome to the Picard News podcast, in which we delve beneath the uniform to the very latest developments from Starfleet Command. As we kick off this in-depth Warp Speed special, I should take a moment to beam in my two trusty bridge officers. At Tactical, we have a Klingon officer currently on assignment as part of Starfleet's officer exchange program, serving as first officer on the Klingon vessel Belhend. She is a warrior of no small renown. She is Tehri of House Chicks. Chicks, Terry. Chicks is apparently, I don't quite know how to pronounce it, but that is Klingon for white. I looked it up on the internet.
Oh, I thought you were doing it because it sounds like chicks and I have a vagina.
No, it wasn't intentionally sexist. That's just what the Klingons sound like. Anyway, joining us at the con is an officer who truly is one of a kind. But only since he was freed from the collective some weeks ago. You may be a celebrity, you may not want to be his friend, but resistance is futile. It's Boyd of Borg, tertiary adjunct to Unimatrix Pilot TV. Hello, Boyd.
You've slipped into self-parody this very early stage this week. I mean, I was hoping you'd do the whole intro in Klingon, but you've ducked out.
That might have been asking a bit much. I have to say, we are entering a podcast that follows the New York Comic Con, which debuted a trailer for Picard, a trailer for Star Trek Discovery, and a trailer for season 4 of The Expanse. I bet you are all looking forward to talking about those three things.
What was the second?
Star Trek Discovery.
I thought that was the same thing. I was like, what, they're different things?
No wonder you're not that interested in Picard.
No, it's Picard, Discovery, The Expanse. It's like a trifecta of nerdy spacefaring goodness.
Is The Expanse linked?
No.
In no way.
No, that's totally misleading.
Yeah.
Because the first two are Star Trek and the second one isn't. Third one isn't.
Not everything has to be Star Trek, Boyd. It's all one big happy sci-fi family. Oh, see, no, I didn't. But yeah, so okay. You know what? Let's jump right into the Picardness of it all. Did you watch the trailer?
Wait a minute, you're jumping straight to news.
Well, I thought we'd just embrace this and do it now. Let's get it out the way.
Okay.
Let's spare. Okay.
I mean,
listeners.
To be fair, your fans, your fan base, of which is weirdly large on social media, are clamoring for like some kind of spoiler special, half an hour. I mean, maybe even 3 hour analysis of the trailer.
I have booked the booth all afternoon.
Fair enough. Mm. I did watch it, and even I, who am a a passing fan, if you like, of the Next Generation series. I was a huge fan of original Star Trek, and for me, that's still the golden Star Trek. Even I thought, oh, that's exciting. And they've got loads of people from Next Generation.
What was your favourite bit?
I can't remember. I watched it a week ago.
Excellent. There's a lot. Terry, did you watch it?
Nope.
You planning to?
Nope.
Okay, then.
What was your favourite bit?
I mean, what to say? I mean, there's so much. There's an original Romulan bird of prey in there. That was nice to see.
I definitely didn't realise that.
7 of 9 dual-wielding phase rifles. That was quite fun as well.
Yeah.
There's an implication that she might, if you look at her uniform carefully, be working for the Romulans in some capacity. That was quite fun. You see her hugging someone. Could it be Chakotay? That'd be a bit weird, but they were having a thing at the end of Star Trek Voyager. What else was in there? Jonathan Del Arco made an appearance as Hugh, the self-aware individual Borg from the episode I, Borg from Star Trek The Next Generation. We see number one, not the dog, Terry, not the dog, but the actual number one, William T. Riker, played by Jonathan Frakes, and Marina Sirtis as Counselor Troy. So there's a lot of goodness in there. There's lots to unpack.
You mean you already are? Because you're already.
Am I already this? I'm already boring everyone.
The Picard trailer news to the front of the podcast, which is, let's face it, scary and naughty.
Yeah, it is.
And you've already banged on about it quite a lot, but you know, it's fine.
It was good. It was a very.
And they
good
also announced. They also announced that when it arrives, which is more important, isn't it? January 23, off the top of my head.
They did, yeah.
2020.
January 23.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or the 23rd of January.
Yeah.
Your face while you said that. Oh my God. Like literally, it's not even. I wouldn't use the word smug.
I would.
In my element, perhaps.
It's like an entirely new. It's like there should be a German word invented for what your face just did.
It's sort of, what's the German for unbridled joy? After German, they probably don't have a word for unbridled joy.
Unbridled masturbatory joy.
Yeah, I think we need a German word for that. I know we have a number of Deutsch listeners, so if you could come up with a compound German word for unbridled masturbatory joy, we will reveal it on next week's podcast when I talk about this again. But yeah, so it was a good trailer.
The
Discovery trailer. Wankenfreuder.
Yeah, that's what I'm going for.
All right, Wankenfreuder it is. Yeah. So continuing the theme of Wankenfreuder, the Discovery trailer I thought was quite nice because that shows the new era of that. Now that they're in the future and unfettered by the existing timeline and canon, seems like they're going to take some risks there, and that's very exciting, which is very true of The Expanse as well. So, Terry, you're going to end up watching this because obviously we're going to review it, but this is a good place to get into The Expanse because season four is not just where they skip to Amazon, so it'll be sweary, fucking A, but also it's like, I think it's a bit of a cutoff, like it's a bit of a new era. So it's like the close of, you know, the first storyline, and it's the opening of another broader storyline. So it's probably a good jumping in point for you. Won't that be fun?
You are.
Excellent.
So it's now a fucking Expanse, is it?
It's the fucking Expanse now.
Yeah.
Or Expanse
I'm
fucking,
surprised
you
didn't go to New York Comic Con because, you know, this amount of pure Jamesian, Dyer-esque stuff. And you weren't there.
I know. It's amazing they did it without me.
Anyway.
Getting back to the normal structure of the podcast, what have you been watching this week? Boyd.
I am halfway through El Camino, the film, and yet on TV, because it's not really in cinemas and won't be eligible, for example, for the Oscars because it is a TV.
Are you going to call Irishman TV? Or would you call The Irishman a film?
The Irishman is showing in cinemas and is valid for the Oscars, whatever the word was.
Eligible.
Thank you. And valid.
All I would say is film isn't where and how you see it. Cinema is where and how you see it. Film isn't where and how you see it.
Oh, okay.
Anyway.
Could I just say, your face when you did that was the equivalent of my face.
Yeah, it was.
When I talk about Picard.
Anyway, the film or isn't it a film debate continues, but the actual belated one-off sequel, feature-length sequel to Breaking Bad, El Camino, so far, an hour in of its 2 hours, I'm very much enjoying it. I read before I got to watch it. So it arrived this morning, recording this on the morning of, what is it, the something or other of October?
11th.
Friday, thank you, the 11th, when it arrived on Netflix. And immediately, very quick, nerdy people started reviewing it, as fair enough. And someone said on Twitter, I saw someone saying on Twitter, oh, this is very self-indulgent. Who needs it? What's the point of it? It's pointless, you know, to go back. I'm like, well, because we love those characters, we love that show, and we're going back to it. And it's everything's pointless, really. What's the point of anything?
Particularly
the
nihilism rules.
Yeah.
Oh, that was uncalled for.
But so I'm really, really enjoying it, and that's the point of it. And you get to see roughly what happened to Jesse at the end of...
Good.
Right at the end. It picks up right from the end of the finale of Breaking Bad, which is one of the great finales in TV history, of one of the great shows in TV history. And I'm loving it so far. And it's very cinematic, I should say. So the original show was cinematic.
It was.
But it was definitely TV. This is widescreen, which is different and new. And I feel like the way it's shot is, to give Terry... to underline Terry's point, much more cinematic and feels like it is made to be seen in cinemas, oddly, considering it is made to be on Netflix.
Well, and they, we should say that they have said explicitly, this is Breaking Bad, the movie, that this is a movie of the TV show. Quite clearly, that's the case.
Yes, well, fair enough. in terms of what it looks like, because it does look lush.
Okay.
And I'm going to mention one other show. This is my equivalent of Terry's, you know, those shows that Terry mentions, like The Apprentice and such, which are comfort TV. Bake Off you've got into this year. Shows that you want to have there, which give you warm glow and make you feel better about the world and yourself and life.
Oh, sorry, you mean like reality TV, which we are sort of almost not allowed to discuss because this is the pilot TV podcast, those ones.
We don't review them, but we are allowed to mention them in the things we're watching section, I feel. Because Terrace at the
All right, that's a loophole.
Anyway, this isn't reality TV. This is a panel. Would I lie to you? It's the greatest show on television.
No, oh, I thought you were going to say something else.
Sorry, what do you think I was going to say?
Strictly Come Dancing.
Oh, no. God, don't start.
I'll leave that to you. But would I lie to you? The single greatest panel show in the history of television. It is Rob Brydon, David Mitchell. It is.
What's
fantastic.
The basic setup? Explain it to me.
Lee Mack. It is. It's a bluff show. So it's famous people telling stories about their lives, which may or may not be true, and it's up to the other team to guess if they're true or not. So it's about, can you bluff? Can you make up a story on the spot based on what they give you on the card? So the card might say, "I once danced with Donny Osmond, slow danced with Donny Osmond on a TV show," which is like would be my one, right? And you have to guess whether that's true or not. And then they ask lots of questions and they delve into the story. And it's just, it's a very simple idea, but it's all about the interrelationship between Rob Brydon, the host, Lee Mack as like the working class northern guy, and David Mitchell as the posh southerner. It's a, so there's kind of class conflict going on between the three of them.
Not unlike our podcast.
Not unlike a podcast, exactly. And it is just, once you get into it, it's so brilliantly entertaining. And Victoria Coren Mitchell is in the new series on David Mitchell's team, and that alone is a joy.
My boyfriend's obsessed with this. Oh, I don't get it. He made me watch it. I'm like,
really?
You make up a story in which one's meant to be fake. I mean, who gives a fuck?
Oh, fuck. You need to. Oh, okay.
He said it's all. It's the dynamics.
Yeah,
and
they're
different ways they're funny. And I was like, oh, maybe it's a man thing.
God, no, I don't think so. But the episode with Bob Mortimer, the best. Has he shown you an episode of Bob Mortimer? Because
maybe. I don't know.
Okay.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Anyway, it's on 9:30 Fridays, BBC One.
So, Terry, tell us about Strictly Come Dancing.
Well, okay, so there's two things. I'm going to start with one you won't shout at me for before I get to the one you almost certainly will shout at me for. So, The Affair, Season 5, which we reviewed when it started and is one of the few things, actually, I've really kept up with. And we talked at the start when we reviewed it about the fact that it's quite unusual because half their cast has fucked off. So Joshua Jackson's no longer in it. Pacey Forever, he bought her a wall. And Ruth Wilson, who's obviously one of the people having the affair in the beginning, is no longer in it. And there's a time jump, and Anna Paquin was essentially part of that time jump, playing Joni, the daughter of Cole and Alison. And I was quite cynical about whether this could work. I am so bang into this entire thing for a couple of reasons, one of which is Maura Tierney, who plays Helen, is just kind of like come to the fore of the entire thing. She was always incredible. I mean, she was great in ER as Abby Lockhart, but here she absolutely steals everything. She's got this new awful boyfriend in it, this Hollywood guy.
Cleish Bang. Close Bang from
Yes.
Sorry.
Was he shouting at me? Clash Bang!
The artist formerly known as Clash Bang. Yeah.
Josh Stamberg, we should say. I'm loving it. Parts of it don't necessarily fundamentally work, but I don't care because The Affair, at the heart of it, is quite a little bit trashy and soapy, and you've got these amazing caliber actors in it, but it's a little bit just soapy is the best way to describe it. So I'm living for the melodrama of The Affair, and I'm very much enjoying it every Sunday night. But the other thing that I'm enjoying more, has to be said, is Strictly Come Dancing, which I've avoided like the plague for many, many years. My nanny used to watch it a lot. She loved it. Very popular, I hear. I am pregnant at the moment, and what that means is I am going out far less. If you've ever tried to go to a pub and not have a drink, what the fuck is the point? It's dead boring. So I've been staying in quite a lot, or going to the pictures. And I was staying in last Saturday night and stumbled upon Strictly Come Dancing on Film Week. So on Film Week, they choose a film and they dance a song from that film dressed up as those characters. And it was sick. I was like, oh, this is fairly nuts. Until Annika Rice says, oh, I'm doing Kill Bill And you go, I'm sorry, what? And she comes out dressed as Beatrix Kiddo in the yellow jumpsuit from the fight with the Crazy 88 and does a Charleston to, what was the song? It was the song that plays during the fight in the Crazy 88. I mean, it was the maddest thing I've ever seen. A, she can't dance, bless her, but... It was, if you've ever seen Kill Bill, and obviously the context of that film is incredibly dark, done to the Charleston, which is the most upbeat thing ever, it was the maddest thing. And then the next night, spoiler, she got voted out. And they always do their final dance to the same song, which is My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion from Titanic. So you've got Annika Rice dressed as Beatrix Kiddo, dancing to My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion from Titanic. And at that point, I honestly was like, I feel like I've been sniffing glue. This is the maddest thing I've ever seen. But also, British telly is amazing. Like, you know, US telly with your high production values and blah, 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 and your, you know, amazing narrative arcs. Give me Annika Rice, like, dicking about on a dance floor in a completely inappropriate and mad way, and apparently I am all here for it. Maybe it's because it was film week, I don't know, but how have I not been watching this for like a decade?
The next issue of Pirate TV is going to take an interesting turn.
But am I the alone in this, Boyd?
No, of course. Yeah, this is my world. This is my other world where I have to watch things like this anyway. Yeah, of course, it's amazing, yeah. I mean, I'm more of an X Factor man, of course, but... Strictly, it is a remarkable thing. It is like...
But it could exist nowhere. My thing is, I watch it and I'm like, this could exist nowhere else in the world. This is British eccentricity to... I know the format exists in lots of
Dancing
countries.
Dancing with the Stars.
But Dancing with the Stars. But if you watched Dancing with the Stars...
No, I'm with you.
I was in LA 3 weeks ago and I watched Dancing with the Stars and it had Dawson, by the way, who's amazing. James Van Der Beek, I should say. But it was, you know, polished and smooth and cool. This is not polished. Yeah. It's not smooth. It's not cool. Yeah. It's shambolic. It's like, it's farcical. It's so inappropriate and weird in places. It is so brilliantly, beautifully British. And I'd like to take a moment to say I was proud to be British at that moment.
And didn't one of the contestants fell over, didn't she?
Fell over. And
this
then,
is gold. James, this is gold. Come on.
She tripped up and then he tried to pick her up. Yeah. And she was like, no, just keep going. And then she went upstairs and she fell over again. And her ex-husband, who she cheated on last season, was stood behind, giving her the dead eye. It's like, oh.
James has just about managed to pay some kind of attention to that. But
I was actually listening. I mean, like, with absolute contempt, that kind of goes without saying, but I was kind of listening. Because the Empire WhatsApp group was awash with tweets and pictures and stuff about this on the weekend, and I had to mute a lot of you.
I came in on Monday morning and said, can you imagine who in this room muted the Empire WhatsApp group this weekend?
I'm surprised you didn't remove yourself.
Oh, God, it was very tempting.
Yeah.
James,
what have you been watching?
What have I been watching? Well, apart from Battlestar Galactica, which I'm obviously ploughing on.
Don't tell the bride.
Did you watch that?
No, I'm just trying to find out the least likely thing that James would watch.
I don't know what that is, but no, I wasn't watching it. No, I was catching up on The Good Place.
Oh, okay.
So I watched the first couple of Good Places and...
Boyd's like,
The Good Place. So The Good Place.
Wait a minute, random though, because the most recent series finished like a while ago.
No, it just started.
Oh, it just started.
Yes,
oh, yeah,
remember we were going to review it on this very podcast, but they didn't make it available.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, the first two have dropped, probably three by the time people hear this, and it's fine.
Oh, God.
It's one of these things. Like, so The Good Place was one of the best comedies on TV, and it had two incredibly strong seasons, and then it just went off the boil. And I was really hoping that season three was a blip, an anomaly, but this is the fourth and final season. And so far, it's not bad. It's not great. It's fine. And it is the final season, and I think it is time for this show to shuffle off to The Good Place, because I think it may have run its course. Like, they're doing, like, the gags are fine, but they're the same gags. You know what I mean? It's the same things over and over again. And for a show that's reinvented itself so many times and done so many incredibly interesting and bold and groundbreaking things, it feels like they're now kind of retreading a very familiar territory. They may have some massive rug pull just around the corner. Who knows? Maybe episode 3, which will have aired in between recording this and airing it, was the greatest thing ever on television. But I doubt it.
Do you know, can I just say I was thinking of The Good Fight because I got confused. I'm not an idiot. I'm aware of The Good
I'm behind on The Good Fight, actually. Yeah. I'm behind. I still have to watch the rest of the
last season. Good Fight, which was great. There was nothing fine about that.
No, it's good. That's very good. Very good. But I'm
slightly disappointed that The Good Place isn't outstanding in its final season.
It's not. Okay. It's not. But it might be. We're only two episodes
early
in.
Early days.
It may become awesome.
Right.
And I should emphasise it's not bad. It's fine.
Fine.
Should we get into news?
Yes.
I mean, we've covered off a degree of the news already, but I'm sure there are other things to talk about. Who wishes to kick us off?
I could do three stories in one.
Wow.
Oh.
There are three cinema auteurs, I'm calling them, who have announced TV projects this week.
Okay.
You aware of this? So I'm going to reel them off in one go.
Do it.
Alfonso Cuarón.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
Is going to television. He's got a multi-year overall deal with
The
Apple.
Expanse seasons 5, 6, and 7, which is unexpected, I thought.
Whatever. So Apple TV Plus he signed with. There must have been a mini, I'm reckoning, war among the various streaming services, but they've snapped him up for various projects and with his production company, which he will be involved in various ways. And his last TV show was Believe on NBC, which wasn't very good.
Mm.
So, but that's interesting.
Okay.
Dario Argento.
Right.
Beloved of horror nerds like me, is going to direct an entire series called Longinus, or Longinus, however you pronounce it, long with I-N-U-S at the end.
It's not what it sounds like.
I know, not long anus, involving mysterious murders, esoteric elements, and ancient enigmas. He's 79, he hasn't done anything since 2012, and he's been given a whole effing series to do. And I'm already on board for it.
Okay.
The title of the series, Longinus, is a reference to the name given to the Roman soldier who pierced the side of the crucified Jesus with a lance to make sure he was dead.
Yep.
How about that?
I didn't know that was his special name.
Yeah. Then finally, Nicholas Winding Refn, he of that bizarre show on Amazon Prime that I watched all the way through and was really boring. I had to fast forward because it was so boring, but had amazing bits
in between.
He's
making another one.
He's doing another one, this time for HBO, and he's doing a TV series adaptation of cult film franchise Maniac Fucking Cop.
You're kidding.
I am not kidding.
You're kidding. How did I miss this? Nicholas Winding Refn is making Maniac Cop the series
with the original John Hyams, the creator of the film series. It's the least likely project in TV history.
It really is.
It's fucking weird, but that's happening. For HBO.
I don't even know what to do with that.
Yeah. And he's going to direct the whole thing with John Hyams. There you go.
Okay. Wow. How do we top that? Terry, can you top that?
Not really. Nothing's happened.
You haven't got, like, Martin Scorsese directing, you know, Hard Target, the series?
I don't, I'm afraid.
No, okay. What have I got in here? David Oyelowo is going to be in Showtime's The President Is Missing, which is about a sort of a vice president who becomes president. You know, that's that old trope. And there's a world-threatening crisis going on, which in itself sounds a bit meh, but David Oyelowo is very good. So
he is. Amazing.
I am down with that. Also, Damon Lindelof said some interesting stuff about Watchmen. That he wrote this as a, he designed it as a single season event.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly that. So he, when he was at Comic-Con, he was talking about this, and he was saying that it doesn't necessarily mean there's not going to be any more.
Right, I was going to say, like, because there will.
Yeah, I mean, because
they're
clearly,
not putting this amount of money into a limited series that's never going to come back.
But he said that he doesn't know if he's going to be working on him anymore, and he said he designed that these 9 episodes to be a complete self-contained thing, like the original sort of 12 issues of the comic. So it's supposed to be a standalone. But obviously, you can bet if it gets ratings off the chart that another bunch of them will miraculously appear, I would say.
The interesting thing about Watchmen is whether we're going to get to see it in advance before next week's show.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? So it would be next
Not
week.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Let me just tell you
and
tell
we'd better
now.
Get hold of that.
Yeah.
That's important.
Yeah.
What else has happened?
Threatening
it.
HBO.
I'm threatening them.
HBO. We better get it.
That's right. Yeah. Give us Watchmen.
No one yet has been able to review it, so we'll see.
We're not stuck in there with them. They're stuck in there with us.
Can I just mention one thing, though, which I found out just today, which is that Pose Season 2 is going to be on soon. So end of October on BBC Two. Because remember they took a fucking, like, about 9 months to show Series 1.
But it's still going to be quite a considerable
It's still quite long, but it was about a year.
Time,
yeah.
Right?
But at least it is this same calendar year as Season 1 on BBC Two. So it's arriving, I think, like around October 26, 27. Because people have been asking me that pretty much since Season 1
I've
went
got
out.
A question. Are Pose stands called Poseurs?
Oh, Christ.
Yeah, maybe.
No?
No.
I mean, okay. Yeah. I'm just saying, I like that we have these kind of collective comedy pun nouns for people who like TV shows, and I'm wondering if that's what they are.
People who have seen Season 2 say it's like we liked, we reviewed it, we liked season one.
Yes.
But season two apparently is a huge step up on season
yes.
one, they say.
Our creative director has been...
I was thinking of him.
Is across this. Yeah.
He is a poseur.
He is a poseur. And he definitely says yeah. that this is a massive leap on, both, I think, in terms of performances and storytelling. Yeah. And I think that's part of the clamour, is that kind of
exactly, yeah.
vibe has spread over from the States and we can't even get our eyes on it. What's behind that lag? Is it the same as...
So it's BBC Two signed this big overall deal with FX, who show it in the States, and they just, it doesn't seem to be their priority to show them these things they buy in any particular urgency, sense of urgency. So it's annoying. Yeah, I guess they must have research that tells them their audience just was happy to watch it months and months and months after it goes out in the States, and they're not the kind of people who
that research exists.
I don't believe it exists either.
No,
because nobody's going to go. I don't know anybody who's like, oh, I'm not that fussed. I'll can take it or leave it.
It is bizarre, though, yeah. Yeah, it's weird.
Any more news from either of you, or is that it?
It's, I mean, who cares? But Clive...
Wow, you're selling that.
Clive Owen is joining the Apple drama Lissy's Story, which is obviously the Stephen King book adaptation, starring Julianne Moore. I'm mainly interested in this because I have a new obsession with Clive Owen, which is based entirely upon his performance in Gemini Man.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't you think he... I meant to... We did a Live Empire podcast last night where James and I were not fans of Gemini Man. And I forgot to talk about this last night because I became obsessed with his performance in Gemini Man, which is like Nicolas Cage in Face Off... When he's, do you know what it is? It's John Travolta being Nicolas Cage in Face Off after the Face Off swap. That's what Clive Owen is in Gemini Man.
I actually can see that.
Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's and I was like, I don't know if I've ever seen that version of Clive Owen. Yeah. He's always been kind of, he's that kind of blank page actor, you know.
Yeah, he's quite low level, not expressive. But in this, he's over the top evil.
He's crazy, like hammy. And all I kept thinking of was Nicolas Cage and Face Off. So I can't work out if I now have more respect for him and want to see him in more things or want to see him in less things and never see him in anything again because his performance was nuts but also kind of one of the more memorable things about Gemini Man, arguably. Yeah.
More than the fact there are two Will Smiths.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
that says a lot.
There may be two Will Smiths, but there's only one Clive Owen.
There's only one Clive Owen being John Travolta playing Nicolas Cage.
What's
with
he
a different
be on
face.
TV again?
It's Lissy's Story, Julianne Moore, Apple TV, J.J. Abrams, Bad Robot production. I think he's going to play her husband.
And that was news.
Nothing, if TV people, please make something happen before the next podcast. So
we've got four shows to review.
Yeah, so that's true. We should skip on. But before we get onto this week's reviews, we have a guest. We have a guest this week. With Living With Yourself airing this week and her brilliant comedy This Way Up already available, Ashlyn B stopped by for a chat about all things humour related. She was, it has to be said, deliriously funny. And despite the fact that this interview descended into utter chaos within literally the first 10 seconds, this was loads of fun. So here it is.
Can we just say, for anyone who's listening, that James is a great man, very respectful of women, and was very careful with me during, and I really appreciated that. And that was what I would love to say on behalf of James and his family.
That's staying in the podcast.
Great.
Ashlyn B, welcome to the Pilot TV podcast.
Thank you for having me, a Pilot TV podcast.
Your fans are out quite a significant force outside, I've noticed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my children.
Yes, your Extinction Rebellion fans.
Yes, I'm like the Pied Piper with them. I told them, wait outside of Trafalgar Square until I'm finished my media event, and then I'll come and talk to you.
That's fair.
I'm big with kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's small with adults, big with kids.
And giant pink octopuses being kettled by the police, sort of middle
of the road. Yeah. That's where the problem with octopuses is I do love calamari, so we have a love-hate relationship with them.
That's going to be problematic.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So, this is a show in which you play Paul Rudd's identical doppelganger. And I must say, you look exactly like him, and it's an extraordinary performance. Yeah. So well done.
And what I really want to say is that Paul, who plays a character, an Irish wife in the show, his accent is very hack, but I actually think his boobs look amazing.
They do.
Throughout the show.
He's very versatile.
He is very versatile. And I loved playing other Rudd. Rudder. The Rudder one. As we say in showbiz. it's brilliant. I am so honestly happy and grateful to like get to talk about a show I love. I hate watching myself in anything, and I think this way up my show kind of knocked that out of me in a way. Like I had to watch the edit and fix it, but it was so nice to. I got this when I was in New York promoting my show, and they put Netflix put all of Living With Yourself onto Netflix, and I was like, you know what, I'll be brave, I'm on my own, so this is not a good idea, because normally if you look at yourself you're like, oh god no. You know the way you get when you listen to your voicemail and you're like, that's not my voice, but with acting it's like your face attached and your effort, and oh, it's awful. But I properly sat down and watched five of them in a row, and then watched the other three when I got home, and I couldn't believe I was in something that I genuinely loved and know people are going to love as well. Like, I love the show, and that's so nice, because sometimes you really have to polish turkeys and go like, well, you know, the lighting in this one is so good and I'll be so proud of the lighting, and you just end up trying to find something to talk
about. See, you say that, but I really liked Hard Sun. I don't know why you're saying that.
I thought the lighting in Hard Sun was brilliant. Thank you very much.
Well, I mean, it kind of goes with the name, doesn't it? The sun was literally on fire.
Yeah, it was very hard sun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you did...
You cheeky monkey, James, for getting a sneer in. Do you remember what I said about James earlier on? He set me up for a fall with that one.
No, see, the worst part of this is I genuinely really, really liked Hard Sun. And
I loved it as well. Yeah, me too. And it maybe was just like a year too early, you know? Like, we have climate protesters down the road, and it was sort of linking into that. Maybe it did come just a year or two too early, just before the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
That happened with, like, well, Sharon and I, in a sense, in that Sharon and I were in Dead Boss together, Sharon Horgan, and that show came out here, and then they made a pilot in America that didn't go anywhere, and then a year later Orange is the New Black came out, and I was like, oh, imagine a place, a situation like a prison, like Dead Boss was situated, where you'd have all of these great female actresses and comedy and darkness beside you that do a star turn. You're like, oh, it was just before it became a great idea. So yeah,
it's all in the timing.
All in the timing, as they say in comedy.
Comedy.
Yeah.
Well, see, you mentioned comedy, and this is off topic, so I'm apologising to the people from Netflix in the room who are glaring at me, but Roisin Conaty, who I'm fairly certain is a friend of yours, she came on and was a guest host on the Pilot TV podcast.
Really? I've never been asked.
You will absolutely be asked next.
God, there's Roisin sleeping her way to the top again.
Yeah, and she came in, and we used to have a segment. See, notice how I'm automatically making this interview all about me. Sorry.
Oh, James.
I'm a man. I apologise.
Yeah.
We had a section on the podcast called Funny or Die. I'm someone who's famously doesn't understand comedy.
Yeah, great.
I don't get it. I find it very...
I can see that.
Challenging. And so this whole thing was that readers would give me comedy shows to watch and I would explain why they're not funny. So I found myself...
Oh, you hellish man.
Yeah.
You're the thing we all fear in the closet.
You've never been in a worse position when you're trying to explain why comedy isn't funny to a professional comedian who's much smarter than you are.
Roisin is maybe, and this is Roisin Conaty, one of my best friends, genuinely one of the most clever people I know, and most verbose people on our subject.
Yeah.
And if you want to talk about gender or the subject in a serious way, I can't. I did a podcast for something recently. I was like, oh, I wish Roisin was here to answer these questions because she is the cleverest person I know. And just how she views the world and her knowledge of the subject and the history and the watching of it and the nuances of our craft.
She wiped the floor with me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But what she said, like, something really rang true with me. And this is something which I think is very true in this way. Is that she said it's not about, you shouldn't write comedy for laughs. You should write it for truth and then bring the humour to the surface.
Well, we're always going to be funny. I remember I worked with this director at drama school, and this is going to sound like it's about Mrs. Doyle in a play, but it's not. It was a lovely note to get, and sometimes I think about it, like, I could do a set, the same 15 minutes, like 20 times in a row, and just one Thursday nobody laughs, and it's really hard to work out what's going wrong sometimes. The director was saying he was working with an actress, and her job was to kind of come in the middle of the scene and ask, did anyone want any tea? Again, this isn't Mrs. Doyle, it was in some play in the West End.
Yeah.
And it would break a serious moment and the audience would lose their mind with this one line. And over the course of the play, the laughs got less and they got less until they dwindled and it was getting nothing. And she was getting really sad, and she said to the director, like, I can't understand why I'm not getting my laughs anymore. And he was like, because you used to come in and ask for a cup of tea, or if anyone wanted a cup of tea, now you come in and ask for a laugh. Mm. And it sounds so silly, but it's it's expectation versus no expectation, and people will laugh at no expectation, but they see expectation coming. I read this thing recently about like loving or giving with expectation versus loving or giving without expectation. So with expectation is I give you a bouquet of flowers because I know it'll, because I know it'll put a smile on your face.
Yeah.
And then the other version is I give you a bouquet of flowers because I know I'll appear charming if I do. And the second one feels less yummy.
Mm.
The first one is, oh, flowers. The second one's like, that's nice, but why? And so if someone comes into a room telling you something, you've all of the space to listen and laugh when you want, but I'm not totally telling you when to do that. Whereas if you come in going, that's funny, and you're like, oh, okay, I'm laughing, but it's sort of uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, both can exist sometimes at the same time, but that's, yeah, it's a nuanced thing. And sometimes you have to find it. That's the craft of the job.
Yeah.
The actual craft of it and the grit and the work of it.
That is an excellent and very articulate way of conveying something which I have tried to get my head around, which is why I find things like The West Wing funny, but I don't find like sitcoms funny, because there's a heightened reality where comedy exists. And then there's drama, which, when comedy bubbles to the surface and it catches you unawares.
Yeah.
And I always find that's...
And that's better. Just your taste. And when people talk about genre, that's more a genre than what people have started putting things into. Like women are genres, or female comedy is genre. Whereas actually something like West Wing is a type of comedy. They play a lot of their scenes for laughs and silliness. And then there's other types. It's like the different types of ways you entertain yourself. For some people, three people at dinner is a party. Other people, like me, cannot wait to go into a room full of people where there's loud music. And that is everything really loudly spelled fun. This is supposed to be fun in a very loud, heightened manner. And that's my kind of night out. For other people, they're like, oh, and so that's almost like with you with comedy.
Yeah.
And there is room for it all.
It's a broad church.
Yeah, it's a broad church, which I never knew until way after broad church. That's what broad church meant. And so when people go, comedy, you know, it's a broad church. I'm like, I didn't think that was a bloody comedy, mate, to be honest. I think it was less of a wah wah at the end of that one.
Wasn't a lol fest.
Yeah, it really wasn't.
But back to this show.
Oh, yes, please.
But this works on a similar level, because this is funny, but also there it has moments where there's a scene where Paul Rudd is in the car, or a Paul Rudd is in a car, and he has a conversation with you on the phone, and it's properly heart-wrenching. And I think doing that makes funny moments funnier. Do you know what I mean? It really kind of, the juxtaposition, I think, works
also
really well.
How much space we leave and the discomfort of it, knowing you're going to be okay. And I think there is something about putting serious topics in a show with two lead actors who are funny and known for being funny, obviously on very different levels globally. Poor old Paul, great to give him the chance in this show.
What are you gonna do?
Great for him to get to work with me and learn a few tricks of the trade. But in that, there's something about maybe the comfort of knowing, oh, I'll sit through this actually because I know I'm going to be okay. I know at the end of this, in some way, I'm going to get a laugh. And I think for me, that's very much the service of comedy at the moment. And I try to do that with my show as well, going, don't worry, this is more life. Like, there's a laugh coming, and that's how it's an okay, safe space to explore these maybe yucky feelings or things. But it's not going to ruin the whole evening or the whole dinner party or the whole night. You will get a laugh. You'll be okay. You know, and that for me is, I love that with stand up, and I love, and sometimes you do just want to hear someone's story about the time they went on holiday and had too much Vindaloo, and because that's the mood you're in. And then other times it feels so nice and cathartic to get something different. And again, there's space for everything. But it's the effort and the care within what, like the stories that are done about having a bad Vindaloo are done with as much care and craft as the other ones. And there's space for it all. And there's space for it all in one gig. I've seen it happen on nights where there's five comedians and someone comes on with a slow pace or a different genre of comedy or style of storytelling and can get just as much as laugh, and you can just love all the different types of people. And I love that. I love that our art form is making space for more different types of voices, because what's nice is you see that audiences who you think look a certain way don't. You will see someone love this show who might look like you, who might look like a young girl, who might look like an older person, who might have hair, unlike you, James. you know, so lots of different people.
It's a trend for the Pilot TV podcast.
Oh, yeah, it really is. And that's why so much comedy goes over your head, because there's nothing stopping it getting in the way.
If I'd known that's what hair was for, I would have kept mine.
We need to get you a comedy catching hat or wig. But I love that there's currently so many platforms and so much space that people can see themselves in all their different ways, and depending on the mood you're in might look to something different. Like sometimes I just like Jade Adams and Fred Siriex are doing a show at the moment all about the making of snacks, and last night like it was such a heavy intense day of thinking about a lot of stuff and my show and this show and the themes, and that I was like, I can't wait to watch Jade's show about snacks and how are they going to make Munster Munch in the kitchen without knowing the recipe. And I was so, that's what I needed.
Yeah.
And then other times I want to then and all weekend I was watching that is it called Capture?
Which I love.
And myself and Roisin are both so invested in Capture at the moment.
Amazing.
But I also want to watch Jade's show about how they make snacks, a competitive show about trying to recreate snacks in a kitchen.
Yeah.
So there's room for everything, and there's room for all of your complexities. You don't have to just, it's not that you don't enjoy dancing just because you like, you know, a real cool indie track.
You can have Pickled Onion, you can have batshit conspiracy theories.
They all live in the same shop.
Indeed. But this show, and I think This Way Up as well, they both deal with the theme of loneliness. You know,
yes, very much so.
And as you say, they deal with it in a kind of comedic way, which makes it not like where Shane Meadows will batter you round the head with the misery, which is fine.
Yeah.
But it's not always time for that.
It's not even always time for that. It's that that's not everyone's experience. And I think what I've felt people have connected to with This Way Up, and what I think a lot of people will connect to with living with yourself, is more, oh, there I am. That's more all of us than total tragedy. And sometimes you can feel a bit guilty about feeling low or feeling disconnected from yourself or society or your family or your partner, because you're like, well, nothing really has really happened though. There's no big catastrophe, there's no big grief-stricken moment, there's no big thing, and yet here I am within a disconnect to myself. And I think more people carry that around with themselves but don't get the privilege of like taking a sabbatical or walking away from work or not having to go into the office or to stop being a parent for a weekend. Like, I'll just put the kid, you know, maybe like in a sort of like boat for the weekend and sail it off. You know, you don't get a break from being yourself. And in this show, the kind of idea that you might get a break from being yourself or not have to be yourself all the time feels like, oh please, just even for a bloody weekend. And that, I think, connects with a very human condition, and one that is relatable no matter what your financial situation is or where you are in the world. And it's something that I've definitely seen, because I mean, Paul's not on Instagram or social media or anything, so he will probably get it from people physically saying it to him. But because I am, I've seen people say it to me. So yeah. I hear and I read. That's the feedback. So you do become a little bit of a researcher in terms of what works very directly with what people come at you with and go, that's me though. And that person that's saying that rarely again looks a certain way.
Yeah.
Which I sort of love. I love that, because it's funny, making a show about loneliness has sort of made me feel less lonely. And I think other people feel less lonely as well, because you go, oh, it's not just me. And I think that's a really important part of storytelling as well, is to kind of connect with someone.
And I love that it was so upfront about the fact that she's in rehab, not for drugs, not for alcohol, but it's loneliness that's brought her there.
Yeah.
And I think that's something, I want to say like maybe 5 years ago, we wouldn't be able to talk about it in the same way. I feel like people talk about mental health now in a way that,
and maybe people wouldn't have taken a risk, and like thanks to Channel 4 for taking a risk on the idea that, and it was a lot to do with obviously Sharon's name being attached as producer and cast in it. But sometimes our biggest thing was always like, does this scene make sense emotionally? And like, oh, there aren't enough jokes in this. And myself and Sherry go, don't worry, it's going to be funny. We would never, ever worry about whether something's going to be funny or not. The same with Paul. I would never worry, oh, is it not going to be funny? Or will we find that? I'm like, no, that's literally what we've been doing and drumming since we were kids.
I
that's how I live. That's how my friends live. That's how my family lives and copes. And sometimes there's this, oh, it's a defense mechanism. If you got rid of that, you'd see the true you. And you're like, no, that's, I mean, it's a defense mechanism. It's better than a gun. It's, I think that's how more people cope in my world, definitely. And it's not necessarily always a mask. It's a part of you rather than something placed on top of you. And I think for a lot of men watching this show, Paul Rudd is such a like, known, loved actor and person from their world, to see him grappling with that, I think is really huge and lovely, in a very small, intimate way, in a small, intimate show as well. And I'm kind of I'm excited in a weird way for people to feel what he's doing in the show as well with his character work, which is, yeah, as I say, amazing that he's playing that Irish woman so well.
Yeah, I look at, he does it very, very well. And you, of course, are good as him. Brilliant. Ashling, thank you very, very much.
Oh, thank
you so much. We will see you
James.
Again when you, because you've already, this is a verbal binding contract, you've agreed to come on and guest host on the Pilot TV podcast.
Yes, so I am also, I, you know, the way when people are like, I don't believe in fairies, I can't wait for the day when you believe in comedy. I'm going to click my heels and go, you know, give you a magic wish. Yeah, every time you say that, a comedian loses their timing.
I'm sorry.
Just so you know.
Thank you very much.
You heard her. That promise to come and host the show, which she did make, was legally binding. Boyd, you did a Q&A with both Ashling and Paul Rudd that very night, didn't you?
Yes, and of course, the first thing that Ashling B said to me as we were waiting in the holding area before he went on stage for the Q&A was, oh yeah, I met your colleague who's also bald and white. And I said, middle class, that's what you're really thinking. I think I kind of emphasise the fact that not everyone who works at Pilot TV is bald, white and middle class and male, but definitely two-thirds of us are. And no, she thought you were very sweet, I think is the word she used.
What?
Yeah.
There you go, see?
I must listen to this interview now. Yeah. What did you do?
I was super sweet, apparently.
Yeah. So somehow you made it all about you, not about the woman you were interviewing, and you still came across as sweet.
It's like a superpower. I think it's something. Because I gave her the nice microphone. Because I was setting up, and I gave her this tripod halfway across London.
God, this is already really boring.
And I put the microphone in there, but she immediately was like, I'm a stand-up, I'm going to hold the microphone. But it was a shit microphone, so I gave her my microphone and I took the shit one, for I am a gentleman.
For you are a journalist. And she's the and she's the talent.
Fine, also that.
You do know there's a difference between interviews and dates, right? Interview, date.
Oh, God.
Ashling B, we'd like to hear your account of your date with James.
I definitely don't think she saw it that way. But she did say that that she would be happy to come on the podcast. I don't believe she meant it, but I'm going to hold her to it.
Since because
her agent was in the room. So.
And she is friends with Roisin Conaty, who has been,
indeed,
of course.
And we discussed it in the interview.
Substitute Terry on this very podcast,
So next time you go off, Terry, to, I don't know, have a holiday or a baby or whatever it is that you do, we will maybe ask Ashling if she will step in.
Feel free. Yeah. I presume that by the time I return, you will be married. And by married, I mean you think you're married. She thinks she's just done two interviews with you and hosted a podcast.
Yes, that's probably true. Right. Well, that segues quite nicely into reviews, where we will start with Living With Yourself. This is the Netflix show created by Timothy Greenberg and starring Paul Rudd as a man who takes a trip to a rejuvenating spa only to have the term self-love take on a whole new meaning when he comes home with a clone of himself, something neither he nor wife Kate, played by Ashling B, signed up for. Boyd, did you have a ruddy good time with this?
Well, brilliant.
Look how pleased he is.
He's so pleased with that. I did. The first thing I'm going to say is that I watched the first two episodes ages ago because I chatted to Ashling B for Pilot TV Magazine. And so Netflix kindly, I'm literally talking like a couple of months ago. And I thought, oh, this is interesting because Ashling B often goes on about, talks about how, you know, she's not going to accept like wife and girlfriend type roles anymore, where she's just an adjunct to a male character. And I thought, actually, watching this, even though it says it's a brilliant high concept that Paul Rudd has to deal with a clone of himself that's been created without his knowledge, and they're supposed to have ditched him and got rid of him, and the first scene is him coming out, being buried alive and trying to find the people who did this. And then, but she is his wife, and she has to deal with him and the fact that he's dissatisfied and kind of a bit miserable and annoying and self-absorbed.
Yeah.
A new version of his character comes along who's much more zingy and bakes a casserole and all of that. But in the first two episodes, I was like, oh, actually, there isn't that much for her to do. But you have to get to episode four.
Okay, good. Because I was going to say this. I've only seen two. My big takeaway from this is not enough Ashling B.
Right. Well,
which is what I said to you, right? Yeah. Before you interviewed her, I watched the first two and I was like, where is she?
Right.
And what is her name?
Okay.
And what is her personality?
Fair enough.
She's a genius.
Yes. Now, let me just... I think Netflix should literally have said to anyone interviewing her, you have to watch through to episode four and probably five, because I'm not kidding you, but it does as much of a reverse switch thing... Reverse ferret. ...as Russian Doll. Do you remember Russian Doll?
Yeah,
halfway through, suddenly does a big switch.
Yeah.
So does this. If you get to episode four, it's just all about her.
Yeah.
And she's then key much more than she is in episodes 1 and 2 and 3, yeah, even 3. And then 5 carries on that way. So it's like, it's weird to have kind of, you know, to not to be talking to her about it and to have explaining it.
Yeah.
And yet that's the way the structure, and it's a very boldly structured series, because it starts showing you the same events from different people's points of view, and things that, ideas and objects and scenes and incidents that arrive in episodes 1 and 2 then come back on themselves later on. It is as intricate, really, as Russian Doll. That's the thing I kept thinking of. I mean, there's another clone. It's a clone story in the week of, as you said, Gemini Man. It's like, this is the way to tell a clone story, yeah, not that fucking
do
shit
it better.
Film. But it reminded me even more of Russian Doll, just in an 8-part, half-hour, ostensible comedy, but actually dealing with all kinds of ideas about what it's like to be human. Is the clone as much of a human as the original one? Is the original one's had the experiences, the clones just had memories of the experiences? It's asking really big, interesting questions.
It also,
and it's very interesting and entertaining. I wouldn't say it's amazingly funny, but it's more dramatic.
It's poignant.
And poignant. Mm. There's some really funny bits, but it's much more dramatic than I was expecting, and I really liked it.
And it probes that sort of idea of what is consciousness. Like, are you the sum total of your experiences and genetics, or is there more to it? So we can't really go into the details of without ruining the whole thing. But this is exploring, like, Michael Crichton. Have you ever read his book, Timeline?
No.
There's a similar kind of idea at the heart of that as well, of sort of like, you know, originals and copies and, you know, where does the consciousness reside. But all of that's kind of by the by. This is actually really sweet, and it's really funny, and it's more touching than I thought it would be. There's a scene where the clone is on the phone to his quote-unquote wife, and really heartbreaking. Like, it's got real emotional depth to it, and it's funny, and it's light, and Paul Rudd goofing around with Paul Rudd is never not entertaining. Yeah, I think it's great. I think both of those actors, both of them have huge amounts of charm, and it helps make this an incredibly likable show. It's got that sort of like TV crack quality to it, where each episode basically ends leading into the next one on a kind of semi-cliffhanger. Yeah. So you can't stop watching it. I will absolutely be pressing on with this. I loved it.
You just described TV. There's a bit at the end which makes you want to watch the next one.
No, hang on. I just described all TV except the TV you like, because no procedural ever ends that way.
No, because it's resolved, and actually that resolution is a huge part of psychologically while I'm into it.
I hate that.
I also thought it was a really clever skewering on self-improvement. Modern society is obsessed with self-improvement.
Yeah.
Being the best version of yourself, discovering and unearthing the best and better version of yourself. It's what we're all told to strive for. And he literally does that. As you say, the opening shot of him in a plastic bag, like dragging himself out of being essentially buried alive.
Yep.
When I first started, I was like, what is happening?
Yeah.
It isn't crazy. It's really high concept, I think, especially for a half an hour show to be able to do that. I think the writing is brilliant. He is amazing. The nuance and detail he manages between the two versions of himself. It's not a younger version. It's not like the terrible film we've already talked about. But the slight change in mannerisms and behaviour, that the kind of slight more innocence that the clone has, is all done really, really well. And it's not, because you think for there to be a clear demarcation, you'd have to come up with something quite overt and quite heavy-handed. But actually, he does it all through nuance, which I think is brilliant. And what I also loved is there are these bigger things, you know, what does it mean to be human, about being disappointing, about this constant striving for our best selves. But it also is brilliant on the kind of what is essentially the crushing mundanity of everyday life, right? So you've got a job that you're kind of shit at, and your relationship isn't quite what it... And that's what sells us this concept of a better version of yourself, because if you were just the best version of yourself, everything in your life would be better, when the reality is that everything in your life is kind of mundane and a bit shit. And in that way, it reminded me a bit of like Catastrophe, I mean, meets Black Mirror, but like that sense of it being quite a realistic and detailed look at just the, you know, we all have to get up, we have to go to work, we're in relationships. Yeah. So relationships aren't all about the big moments, it's about the boring moments and the bits in between. So I really liked this. Really liked it.
He mentioned Paul Rudd, mentioned Black Mirror.
Did he?
When I was talking to him, I just wasn't expecting what it is, which is a really interesting. And the guy who wrote it, he used to work on the the John Stewart version of that show, The Daily Show, has had this idea for years and years and years. And they were saying that, you know, I think he probably wrote almost wrote the whole thing, all 8 episodes, and had the idea like years and years ago, 5, 6, 7 years ago. And they were like, okay, let's do this, let's make it. And it's directed by Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, who are filmmakers, you know, and did Little Miss Sunshine. And they, I think they just bring that filmic touch to it really well, because it is like a kind of, you know, each Heart Fair episode is like a brilliant little indie film.
Yeah, it's very, very good indeed. And it airs on Netflix, shot on Netflix on Friday, October the 18th. That is Living With Yourself. Next up this week, we have Amazon's Modern Love. This is an anthology series comprising standalone stories pulled out and dramatized from the New York Times long-running column of the same name. Appearing in this one is an array of people from Dev Patel to Catherine Keener, Anne Hathaway, Andrew Scott, even Tina Fey is in this, and each episode tells a story of romance and how it fits into kind of modern life. Terry, did this stir your loins?
I won't go that far. And actually, I'll correct you a little bit.
Oh,
please do.
Because romance, I think, is an interesting word when you talk about this show, because it's not all about romance.
I was just looking for a synonym, if I'm honest with you.
I did figure that. But it's actually much more interesting than being about romance. So this is based on this very, very famous New York Times column. It's one of my favourite columns in any newspaper ever. So essentially, it's an essay a week. And it's something about love in the modern world. So sometimes it's romantic, sometimes it's not romantic. And that's kind of what you see in this anthology series, which is a different little story, a vignette, if you will, in each episode. It's Daniel Jones, who edits the column at the New York Times, has made this into a book, has made this into a very successful podcast series. He is a consulting producer on this, and they are all specific stories that already existed. Now, what I will say is I found this and I watched the first 2 episodes, and we talked when I'd watched one of them. I actually watched them in reverse order. I watched the second one first, and I wasn't convinced. The second one is Dev Patel, and he's being interviewed by a journalist, and he actually tells his story. He's a founder of a dating app, and he tells his own kind of story of a failed romance. And then it has the journalist who's interviewing him, it has her story as well. And it felt there was something about the setup that felt quite contrived. And even though, especially the second story was so was really poignant and beautiful, there was something weird about seeing these things dramatized, because modern love is all about authenticity. The column works because it is a really personal, first person account of a story to do with love. And the fact that it's real and it comes from one person, it's very much a singular experience. There aren't any grand sweeping statements about love. It's a very much one person story, is what makes the column so brilliant and so addictive. And when you dramatise it in that way, I was losing something. There were moments where I thought it felt a bit corny, and I started to be a bit lost by it. And then I watched the first episode, which is essentially about a woman's relationship with her doorman in New York, which, let me tell you, is a complex relationship. And that had much more kind of subtlety and points of interest for me, and I thought was much more interesting. Catherine Keener, by the way, plays the journalist in the second episode, and she says, there's a quote from her at one point where she says, "Sometimes you realise that true love in its absolute form has many purposes in life. It's not actually just about bringing babies into the world or romance or soulmates or even lifelong companionship." And that thread of what is love in the modern world, who do you experience love with, and what does love look like in all its kind of oddities and small ways, is what makes this interesting. But I also think that's what makes it kind of patchy in some ways, because some will connect and some won't, and some will be about love you find interesting and others won't. But there were definite moments in that second episode where it just became a bit American. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
Like cheat, like...
Yeah, it's... Yeah. But it's also... So we should say it's... Most of these are written and directed by John Carney, who did Sing Street, who I like,
yes,
but definitely has a tendency, shall we say, towards...
Like in Sing Street.
Like in Sing Street, to reveling to some extent in you know, emotion, and you know, if it goes, if you don't like it, then sentimentality. Now, I really like Sing Street, but you know, there's definitely a thing going. His episodes feel like things that his stuff altered by him, rather than a way of doing what is so interesting and unique about the column, which, as you say, is the authenticity.
Yeah.
Now, the best episode, now I've watched 4 or 5 of them, including the first two that you mentioned, and Sharon Horgan's episode, which she wrote and directed, starring Tina Fey and John Slattery, which is by far the best, because it is brilliantly authentic and real, because it's Sharon Horgan doing this without the sentimentality.
Yes.
And it is a fantastic little vignette of basically Sharon Horgan is playing the wife of John Slattery off Mad Men, not Tony Slattery off. Whose line is it anyway?
I would watch that though.
So would I.
She is like an adjunct figure, funnily enough. He's this egotistical, charismatic, creative who's famous, who people would come up to in the street and go, "I love your work," leaving her standing there not knowing what to do or say. There's one brilliant scene, jump where Jonathan is by, they're on the side of the street, one side of Central Park West or whatever in Manhattan. And he sees some people on the other side. He runs over to see them, crosses the massive street road. You live there. You know what that street is. You know how big, wide that street is. He crosses the road in a second. Then she's like, "What do I do now? Like, he hasn't invited me over. He's not introduced me to these people. He knows. So I'm going to cross the road and see them." And he gets run over, and she has to like dodge between 5,000 different cars just to get to find out what the fuck her husband's doing with these people, because he pays no attention to her and her whatsoever. There's so much going on in this episode. I thought it was so great. But I feel like saying it's kind of because Sharon Horgan is so great at this stuff, you know. And Tina Fey plays it very much against type. She's not playing it for laughs. She's brilliant in it. It's quite a kind of poignant role for her. And it leads up to this big scene where she confronts her husband with this thing that's gnawing at her. And it's so satisfying. And it does leave, I felt, a lot of the other episodes slightly in the dust. I've watched the Andrew Scott episode, in which he's half of a gay couple, and they are going to have a surrogate child. And the surrogate mother, the mother, is a homeless woman. And that's really interesting. And I felt slightly uncomfortable with that one, because it felt a little bit, I don't know, there's something very middle classy about it, even though it's partly about how this middle class gay couple are going to deal with this woman who's homeless living in their world and having their baby for them. But it was really interesting and quite authentic, more authentic again than those first two, I thought, or at least that second one. So obviously it's variable because it's 8 completely separate stories. It's much better than the last time they did this kind of thing, which was the Romanoffs. Remember that? When the guy who created Mad Men did 8 separate stories and they were by and large terrible. These are interesting, and it's an interesting, you know, offshoot from the column. But I agree with you in that. I don't think they quite capture most of them. What's unique about the column?
I love this.
says Mr. Titanic lover over there. Mr. Actually, yes, underneath yes, it all, yes. Massive, squidgy, romantic yes. James Dyer.
This ultimately is, I'm a massive soppy twat, and unfortunately, like, this really got me, especially, I loved the first one with the doorman. I thought that was super sweet. And the second one, I loved both of the storylines. The Catherine Keener storyline about...
Even the Dev Patel storyline.
The Dev Patel one really got me. I was like...
There was one point where I rolled my eyes so hard, I was like... Not wrong.
I was almost tearing up. I was, that really got me. I was like, this is so sweet. I thought it was massively romantic, and it really got me. This did. The only thing that I did do is I read the respective columns. So each one is pulled out of a specific actual column.
Yes.
And they bear very, very little resemblance to the actual columns in terms of substance and story and how it pans out. Like, they've been heavily editorialized and dramatized for the screen. So if you're looking for an accurate representation, you ain't going to find it. Specifically the Dev Patel one. Dev Patel is actually playing the founder of Hinge, the dating app. He's the actual person who was at the center of the story. And the story really neither one of those stories in that episode bear a great deal of resemblance to the actual stories they're based on.
Because I totally agree with Terry on that. I found it awkward, that the whole device of the journalist interviewing him. I just didn't buy Catherine Keener in that.
No.
I just felt, I love Catherine Keener, but I just didn't work.
But,
it just didn't,
but that whole like, and now I'm going to tell my story.
Exactly.
That two-hander, I was just, and I understand what it's saying, which is everybody has their own love story, right? And everyone has their own story to share and their own thing they carry with them at all times. I understand that, but I found that the construct itself felt so...
It feels clumsy in that episode. But I think the reason is that, and we can't really go into the exact reason, but the resolution of how that story ends is true to life, and there's sort of I think that there's a relevance to doing it that way. But yes, having a story within a story there is a little bit like could these have not been two separate stories?
Yeah,
but there is a purpose for it. But no, I thought it's sweet. I think if you have a high tolerance for sappy shit like this, and if you love a bit of Richard Curtis, then I think there's loads here to love, and I should be watching every single one of these anyway. Modern Love, I enjoyed it lots. You will too, unless, like Terry and Boyd, you have a heart of stone.
We liked it, I think it's like any anthology series, right? So every new season of Black Mirror, there are episodes I like, episodes I don't like. I think that's just the nature of it, because not every story is going to connect with you. And I think when it's something like this, and you've got a disparate group of actors, a disparate types of stories, trying to cover, think about love, right, without getting too, you know, existential. Think about love. It's the biggest subject in the world, and every kind of love that exists and exists within us, and every kind of relationship we have. I think it's such a broad palette, which does work within the column, but I think obviously it can make it quite scattershot when you're trying to watch one season of a show.
I like the fact that this doesn't seem to have a thread of cynicism to it. It has a sort of an honest abandon to it, which I very much
liked. I think the Sharon Horgan episode is different.
Well, so, perhaps. Yeah. Of the two that I've seen.
Anyway. Yeah, because the columns are tonally are all over the shop. Yeah. Because they are one person's real story of their, you know, life.
Yeah. Anyway, Modern Love, Friday, October 18th on Amazon. Next in this week's lineup, we have a Girl Haji, which means duty shame in Japanese.
Giri Haji.
Oh, God, I did it again. I keep doing that. Did I literally say it? I can't believe I said it. I say that every time. I know it is. Right.
God, gone mad. He's lost it.
I can't do it. Right. Next up in this week's lineup, we have Giri Haji, which means duty shame in Japanese. This is a continent and culture-spanning crime drama slash mystery that sees a Japanese detective played by Takehiro Hira, who heads to London to investigate the murder of a Yakuza gangster that may tie back to his family. Kayleigh McDonald also stars as DC Sarah Weitzman, a Met officer who gets pulled into the whole affair. This is shot in both English and Japanese with, I would say, half and half splits, 50-50. Yep. 50 English, 50-50 Japanese. What did you make of this, Boyd?
I liked it. It's a very interesting attempt, I think, to by the creator, Joe Barton, who we had a feature on in Pilot, and he said in it, I'm going to quote him, actually, because I think it's interesting. He talked about the influences on the show, and he said, it's not necessarily shows similar in subject or tone to Giri Haji, but ones that have narrative freedom, stuff like The Haunting of Hill House, Atlanta, and Fleabag.
Wow.
Now, I think that, and why I think it's interesting that he says that is, for me, this is like someone trying to take a gangster story, interestingly set in Tokyo and London, and half and half, and there's a whole kind of fish out of water idea because the Japanese detective has to come to London, but he's taking that as the starting off point to make his own version of this kind of peak TV, if you like. So he's using all the tricks in the book. Visually, it's very stylish, it's stylized.
Very much.
And the storytelling. So in episode two, I watched episode two earlier today, I watched episode one, and that jumps back and forwards in time all over the place. Episode one has flashbacks. It's shot in widescreen, and the flashbacks are even wider screen.
Yeah, they are.
Super widescreen.
Super wide.
I'm talking like Ben-Hur widescreen.
Yeah, I know. It's like 70mm.
I'm obsessed with aspect ratios anyway, so I love an aspect ratio switch in anything. This goes for it.
This
massively.
Goes full Panavision.
Goes full Panavision. I'm like, oh, this is interesting. There are little animated elements.
Yes, yes.
You
and
know,
really well done as well.
Really well done. Mm. So in that way, there's a Tarantino influence because, of course, he did all that in Kill Bill particularly. I think Kill Bill, it feels like a particular influence on it as well. I like the fact he's kind of playing with like a box of tricks almost. Like, how can I tell this story in the most interesting kind of playful way? And I'm up for it. I don't think there's anything... Yeah, I guess the central idea that one brother thinks the dodgy gangster brother's dead and then he comes back to life effectively is an interesting idea, but it is the style of it that for me is more the thing that's going to carry on compelling me to watch than the actual story. But I'm still interested in the story.
It is, but the story is one that really pulls you in. And I mean, it's not that I wasn't expecting that. There were two things I think that surprised me about this. I thought Kelly MacDonald was a genius bit of casting in this because she has a real grounding influence on it, because you say it's very stylized, it's very Japanese early on. When it comes to London, I think she comes in, and even in her first scene, she has a really sort of like dry, sort of slightly sarcastic sense of humor that he totally doesn't get because it's lost in the language barrier. But I think that really helps you kind of anchor it in the sort of British aesthetic. And I really enjoyed it. The story pulled me in. It really made me want to watch the next one. And I loved the animated interludes. I thought the one they have in the first episode especially, I thought was really, really well executed. And it is very stylish and it is very Tarantino. And that aspect ratio is really fucking wide. But so it's great. Wide. It felt very original. It felt very fresh. It felt like something I hadn't ever seen before, which is never a bad thing. I hadn't expected to, but I'm definitely going to press on with this. How many episodes do you know in this?
Eight.
Eight episodes of Giri Haji. And this airs on BBC Two. This starts on Thursday, October the 17th at 9 p.m. And I very much recommend it. Finally, this week, we have Sarah Phelps' Dublin Murders. This is an eight-part drama based on the Dublin Murder Squad books by Tana French, specifically the first two books in French's series, In the Woods and The Likeness. It involves a murdered girl, a buried past, personal connections between crime and coppers, and a big old mystery, which also sucks you in from the get-go. Terry, this has bodies, family trauma, buried secrets, all that good stuff that gives you the warm and fuzzies. Tell me you love this.
Yes, this gave me a massive crime boner. So
that's your poster quote right there.
So much of this could have been, trope laden. There are so many brilliant crime dramas, so many kind of average and or terrible crime dramas. And I always think this is one of the hardest genres to actually really nail and set apart from everything else, because there are so many being done. But I think the crucial difference with this is Sarah Phelps, I have to say. And not just because the writing is exceptional. And I don't think it's any small feat. You've got two of these books, these Tana French massive best-selling books, which are really well-known and really loved. And bringing those two together to create one cohesive, compelling... Yeah. I think that's a really massive challenge. But other than that, I have to say the two leads, Killian Scott and Sarah Green, who play the detectives, they're both super compelling, especially her. I kind of fell in love with her a little bit. So she plays Detective Cassie Maddox. Something really interesting about her, really vulnerable.
She's a very you character.
But I'm like...
that scene with Conlon Hill in The Office, I was like, she's basically Terry.
But that makes me a massive narcissist. I really liked her. She's that kind of classic thing with detectives, right? Kind of vulnerable, but bolshy, smart, like brittle. Like, I think she's amazing. I can't wait to watch her more. The production design is incredible. It looks incredible. The way it's shot, the tone and the colour palette, I just think is...
desaturated.
Because people will say this is dark, which it is. There is a scene where they tell the family of the girl, and it is one of the darkest things I've seen ages. It's really fucked up, but really human, really brutal, really unnerving. There's something really eerie about the entire thing. I just thought this was incredibly, incredibly well executed. In terms of quality, it is just right up there. So I watched the first episode. I can't wait to watch the second. But I'm all here for this. I'm all in.
It's one of the things that I found about this is it's pretty dense, but also you really have to pay attention with this. Like, you can lose the thread very quickly. Because I was multitasking a little bit, I had to go back rewatch this.
Yeah, I watched it twice.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, I now actually just need to watch this while doing nothing else because I'm not following what's happening. Because it is quite complex, and to determine, you've got to pay attention to names and faces and who is who, because it's not one mystery. It's a mystery within a mystery tied up within another mystery, and they all kind of interlink, and you're like, okay, you need to keep your head on with this. But there was loads of love. As you said, the performances are really good. Killian Scott, Boyd gave me a fascinating fact about him. Would you like to share it, Boyd?
I can't remember what it was.
Is that Killian Scott's real name is Killian Murphy.
Oh, yeah.
But he goes by Killian Scott.
And he is actually Irish.
Yeah.
Doing a British accent, weirdly.
There you go. But also, I loved Conlon Hill in this, because I love that he's playing the kind of abrasive, bolshy police captain, but with a slightly 2019 twist. Like when he goes, oh, she's not going to call HR, is she? Like, it's really nice. Like, and I thought he was loads of fun. It's nice to see Varys in his post-Thrones incarnation. But yeah, this is absolutely awesome, and I'm going to mainline all of these in the next couple of days because the BBC have made them available, which is lovely.
Yes, and it is Sarah Phelps is just a fucking genius.
Isn't she?
Bottom line.
Yeah, she really
is. Hard to underline just how clever her versions of these things are. Because I read the first novel, In the Woods. I haven't read the second one yet. But capturing the atmosphere, she does that brilliantly. There's a kind of the sense of unease and perversity and nastiness, which is very much her. She loves that stuff. I mean, she's absolutely honest about that. That she finds the real nastiness in Agatha Christie. That's what she's done brilliantly with her adaptations of Agatha Christie for the last few years on BBC One, and the weirdness. But she knows how to tell an incredibly gripping story. I think that's why she loves crime dramas, because she loves immediately gripping stories, but they allow her to go massively off kilter in all kinds of weird directions, explore all kinds of the weirdness of humanity and of human behaviour, and she revels in it, and it's so interesting. This is so much more interesting than almost every other crime drama, and I love a good crime drama anyway, but it's like multiple levels of stuff going on.
So meaty,
so much to it, and as you say, you really do have to pay attention, but in a good way, because once you do, you're completely immersed in it, and you're like, oh, you have to work out who's doing what to whom and who those people are, because she has various timelines, the flashbacks, why is this person connected to that person, and it's the intricacy and the storytelling and the characterization, the two of them, as you say, brilliantly cast, and kudos to everyone, because they're not huge stars. I think he's a bigger star in Ireland, but they could have insisted on big stars for it, for example, but they're perfect, absolutely perfect, and their friendship, and it's a proper friendship, they're not having sex or anything, is so brilliantly observed. And it's absolutely real. Within seconds of you meeting them, they're like, yeah, oh, these two are like, they have something absolutely real
together.
There's
an intimacy to
their relationship. Yeah, it's so clever. It's just fantastic. And, you know, I just pray that they carry on giving Sarah Phelps these amazing stuff to do, because she is absolutely
brilliant. And the one thing I would say, and which I think she is amazing at, is that it made me realise how few shows we watch that actually do require your full attention. The amount of shows where you can do it, as we often do while we're doing other things in the office, while we're watching things, or people will be on their phones. This is a show, you can't be on your phone, you can't be looking out the window, you have to pay attention. And I remember when David Simon first put The Wire out, and he called it lean forward television, where he was like, fuck you, I'm not catering to people who can't be bothered to pay attention. You know, you'll pick it up as you go along, or you won't, and if you don't see it, I don't care. And he made no attempt to pander or to make it accessible. He's like, pay attention, concentrate, and you will follow this. Don't, and you won't. And I think this has the same kind of ethos, where she expects engagement from her audience, and I think this absolutely deserves it.
But the respect, and I think it's respect, right? The respect it shows to the audience. I think especially with this genre, there's often a tendency to dumb down or make it super easy. Complexity is often spoken of as kind of a negative thing, or it's too difficult to follow. I couldn't understand what was happening. But they show the audience, and as you say, the commitment they then expect in return. And I really enjoy the ambition of that from a storytelling perspective. Yeah, it's a crime drama, but it's incredibly well crafted. As you say, the complexity of it is incredible, the layers upon the layers upon the layers. And I just think audiences are hungry for this stuff, and they're smart, and they're engaged, and they're watching loads of great telly, and there's no reason why they can't engage with stuff like this. And actually, as you say, that kind of lean into this and engage with it in a really positive and proactive way, I think it's really exciting. And I just think it actually treats people as they deserve to be treated in this day and age, which we don't expect everything to be passive and easy and just flood into our ears and we don't have to be part of it.
And that is Dublin Murders, which begins on BBC One on Monday, October the 14th at 9 p.m. It has been a great week for telly.
It has. They're showing two episodes a week, by the way.
Two episodes a week.
Monday and Tuesday.
Good to know. FYI. Don't miss the second one. So would that be our pick of the week, Dublin Murders?
Yes.
I would agree with that, Boyd.
Yeah. I mean, I love Living With Yourself as well. But
I recommend everyone watch all four of these. Yeah. I genuinely think, I know you guys didn't love Modern Love Giri Haji quite as much, but I think all four of these are properly good shows, and I'm going to watch all of them.
We modern liked.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, we did. Yes, we did. Right. Now time for the Banshee segment, where we, as ever, find a TV show from ages past and resurrect it Frankenstein-like for your modern viewing pleasure. Boyd, Do you have something for us?
I do, yeah. I was thinking, you know, last week I was talking about Everybody Loves Chris, and the reason I mentioned it was
Everybody Hates Chris.
Sorry, Everybody Hates Chris.
The sequel, Everybody Loves Chris, has not yet
everybody
been made.
Hates Chris, thank you. was because it's really difficult to get hold of the first series anywhere in the world, and I was thinking of things that are difficult to get hold of. That was my leak. And I remember that I spent ages and ages trying to find a copy of this show. So when I first watched it on BBC Two back in 2005, I thought it was hysterically funny. It's a comedy, incredible cast. It's created by John Morton, who did 2012 and W1A, and he's a comedy genius, I think, and he revels in silliness and stupid names and stupid ideas. And this is called Broken News, and it was only lasted for one series. People accused it of being a day-to-day ripoff. You know the Chris Morris show, which of course established Alan Partridge, which was a piss take of news, TV news, incredibly ahead of its time. But actually, Broken News, it does share elements, but it's really reveling in the silliness of all different types of TV. So it's like this format is switching between different cable channels, like local news, proper national news, entertainment news. There's a brilliant piss take of celebrity entertainment news, you know, when you get some a flamboyant guy reveling in Hollywood gossip and stuff. It's got a film review section, which is really funny, taking the piss out of a very earnest, pretentious film reviewer who hates everything. It's got an incredible cast, including Nicola Walker, Sharon Horgan, and Benedict fucking Cumberbatch playing an international correspondent in what is essentially a frothy, silly sketch show. It's really, really funny. It's quite hard to get hold of, but I think you'll be able to find it possibly on DVD.
That's good.
If you really go for it.
Yeah, no, I've never heard of that. But it's funny because Benedict Cumberbatch was like the sort of sort of random supporting actor for years.
Exactly.
He was just like on the periphery of things.
Yeah.
That is the purest banshee we've ever had.
Oh. Thanks.
I mean, do I even bother at this point?
No.
Anyway, that was the Pilot TV podcast. No, I'm going to do it anyway. So to Banshee, I need to get through something before you get to the Banshee. So I want to talk about 21 Jump Street, but that is not my Banshee, okay? So
classic.
You guys have seen 21 Jump Street, right? And I don't mean the film and
film,
the 22 Jump Street. I mean the original 21 Jump Street, which began in 1987, ran to 1991, so five seasons. And this is what made Johnny Depp famous, essentially. So this was a procedural cop show, but they were young-looking cops, young enough that they would then go undercover in high schools, uncovering, rape cases and drug cases at these schools. And it had a bunch of people in it. The guest star list for 21 Jump Street was off the chain. So people who have guest starred in 21 Jump Street include Josh Brolin, Bridget Fonda, Jada Pinkett Smith, Brad Pitt, Vince Vaughn, Shannon Doherty, John Waters, Rosie Perez, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Mario Van Peebles, Christina Applegate, Paulie Shaw, Jason Priestley, Thomas Hayden Church, Sherilyn Fenn, and Peter Berg. That's quite a lot of people.
Have you got to your Banshee yet?
No.
What is happening?
Yeah. Not yet.
What is
not
happening?
Yet. Not yet. So, but
what
I'm
saying
is... Will
you stop this if you had got to the Banshee? I thought I'd like missed the bit where you segued from 21 Jump Street, which is not your Banshee,
this is
to
still
your Banshee.
The prologue to the Banshee.
Oh
okay,
God.
okay. So for 21 Jump Street, this ran for five seasons, but Johnny Depp left after season four, and Fox never even showed the fifth season. It was only shown in syndication. So it was a slightly random satellite end to this, and they never, ever, ever addressed the fact that Johnny Depp's character had fucked off. Like, it was never, ever mentioned. So no one ever knows what happened.
Still hasn't got to his Banshee.
No. But
what has that starring list of people, of cameos, got to do with...
I'm laying the groundwork. Stop backseat Banshee-ing. Right. Anyway. So there was a character in 21 Jump Street called Dennis Booker, played by Richard Greco. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
No, you know who I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Weirdly enough, Richard Greco was in a really weird sort of pseudo-erotic movie where he was a werecat.
Oh my God.
Which I know because I saw it late night on Sky once in the 90s. It was really fucking weird, soft porn Richard Greco and cats. Look it up. It's probably called Cats or something. I don't know, but it'll be on his IMDb page. I highly recommend you don't watch that. But that is not my Banshee either. My Banshee is...
Oh my God, this is pure chaos.
No, my Banshee
I'm
is...
I'm actually sweating now. Tension and stress.
Dennis Booker, who was a character in 21 Jump Street, was...
But none of the ones listed earlier.
...was played by Richard Greco, and he was spun off into a show called Booker, which was the 21 Jump Street spin-off series.
Wow.
And this was the second show that came out. And in this, he kind of works for... He's no longer a cop. He's been hired by this Japanese company to investigate suspicious insurance claims. Absolutely true. And he's a kind of sort of iconoclastic, hating authority type character.
But he works for an insurance company.
Yes, yes, yes. And Laurie Petty joined this at one point. She was in it. It only ran for one season. It didn't do very well. People didn't like it. I really loved Booker because I'd never seen...
insurance broker at work.
Yes, I loved his insurance shenanigans. But the best part of this is, so I watched this. It was way, way, way back when, and Sky One would show 21 Jump Street, but Booker could only be viewed by me on this random German channel. So remember, back in the 90s, your Sky subscription would include things like RTL and slightly odd German things. Now, most teenage boys would watch RTL because there was boobs on it at various points.
I was going to say, wasn't this porn?
Including, as I recall, a game show called Tutti Frutti, where if you got the questions right, you got to get naked, and if you got the questions wrong, you had to get naked. It was very bizarre. I don't really understand Germany.
Who's you?
Anyway, as I'm saying, I used to have to watch Booker on one of these German channels where it was in English with German subtitles, and that is how I remember Dennis Booker in English with German subtitles. It ran for 1 year in 1989. I almost certainly don't think you can buy this anywhere, but you can probably find it on YouTube, I would think, with or without the subtitles. And that is my banshee.
You missed out the key fact that the theme was Hot in the City by Billy Idol.
Was that the key? Yeah. That's the key take. That was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's coming back to me now. I'd forgotten all about that because it had like pictures of the skyscrapers.
I'm not going
the skyline.
To say any more about
no.
it. I'm just saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Terry, I win. Yes, excellent. Right. My Banshee wins. And that is it.
I feel like you need to be like medicated or sedated. I might just put one of those tranquilizer darts in you to see if
Excuse
you like
me.
Makes you shut the fuck up.
Excuse me.
You just talk. Non-stop for like 12 minutes, not about your banshee, in a way to sell your banshee. I do feel like you should win something for whatever just happened, which I don't even know how to describe it, but Boyd's is literally the most perfect banshee at all. It's so good we should rename the section.
Right.
Broken news.
I do not appreciate that characterisation. Ashley B thought I was sweet. Thank you very much. Right. That is it for this episode of the Pilot TV podcast. As ever, we hope you enjoyed it. At this point, we'd normally ask you to sling a 5-star rating our way on iTunes. But honestly, by now, if you haven't given us a review, I'm just going to assume you don't love us and never will. It's fine. It's fine. Anyway, we are, however... open to professions of adoration on Instagram and Twitter at James C. Dyer, at Boyd Hilton, at Terry _White. And you can follow this week's guest and future co-host, Ashlyn B. on at We Miss B. We will be back next week, hopefully answering the age-old question of who watches The Watchmen with us. Pilot out.